Okay, thank you again. This is joint work with another colleague at Celera. His name is Daniel Huson. And then Ming Zhao Song from the University of Washington visited us over the summer, and he also did some of the letter implementation. This is also, I should add a disclaimer here to say that this is not Celera's gene finding strategy. This was a research effort, and you know that Celera published the human genome and they published their annotation of the genes. There is an annotation group who uses a whole bunch of programs, including all the well-known programs like GenScan and so on, and they combine the results, but you know, they work independently of us. So this is like a research effort which aids in that, but it's not. If you ask me why there are only 26,000 genes or 30,000 genes, I don't know. I don't even know how many there are. So. Okay. Let's go back to the slide which I had in the morning. And of course, for those of you who are not there, I'll explain it again. But just, I think many of you probably know this stuff by now, but just to just fix the problem in our head. What exactly do we mean by gene finding? So again, we have the nucleus, and where's the small one? Okay, so we have the nucleus, and this is genomic DNA. This time we'll go a little more into the structure of the DNA. So the box here corresponds to exons, which are the expressed part of the genome. And what will happen is that in the transcription process, from some point here to some point here, there will be a copy made, and this will come out as a transcript after the intervening regions are spliced out. Okay, so this will combine with this and will form the primary transcript. And then again, the process of translation will take place. And what you'd like to really do is, just given this genomic sequence, you'd like to be able to predict what the protein coding sequence is. Oops, have to be careful. Okay. So once again, just to make sure, these are the exons. The yellow region corresponds to the translated part of the transcript. So, and it's another subtle point which is not always obvious, is that while this entire process is copied out and, you know, and this process is transcribed, the translation doesn't begin from the beginning but from somewhere in the middle, and then it ends wherever you see a stop codon. So there could be a lot of non-coding exons, there could be more than one, and also translation doesn't have to begin from the beginning of the exon. However, for gene finding, it's very usual to say that we, you know, if people are finding genes, what they're really doing are identifying the coordinates of the boundaries of these exons, where the first thing they identify is the beginning of translation. So it doesn't really correspond to beginning of the exon boundary here, but it's the beginning of translation, end of translation, and all the intervening splice junctions. Identification of these coordinates is what we call gene finding. Okay, and that's typical in the industry. In this field.
And donors and acceptors refer to the right edge and the left edge of the exon fragment?
Yes, that's a good point. Yeah, the donor site is the site that's sort of the right edge of an exon, and the acceptor is the left end. And there's a signal, we talked about some signals today, there's a signal of the donor which basically characterized with this GT dinucleotide here and an AG, and both of these are spliced out. So the signal, the dominant part of the signal is spliced out, but then of course the signal could extend a little bit here and here.
Are these
mostly
little tiny motifs that indicate the edges of exons are much smaller than other motifs you were talking about this morning?
They're about the same size. Yeah, the variability is again, there's quite a bit of variability with the exception that this GT motif is fairly well conserved in this AG. There are some non-conserved splice sites as well, so it's not always the case, but GT is fairly well conserved. For the acceptor, there's a lot of other theory as well. There are polypyrimidine tracts here. So, you know, you have, TC, right. So you have a tract of CTs here. And there are a few other things which people might actually use to identify the signal. Thank you. But It's not the strength of these signals in actually identifying the splice sites is also under some debate. It's not clear if they help a lot. Okay. Well, this first point I think is quite sort of obvious by now because, you know, as you know, the genome is well in excess of 3 gigabases and a very small fraction of it is actually coding now. So to identify genes, the first step is almost always, especially in new genomes, I think the first step nowadays is just computational because there's too much. Accidentally, people might discover transcripts, and there are other biological methods like ESTs and all, with which you can find fragments of genomes. But this is probably the best first pass at getting where the gene is. Okay. So there are two things that are important in gene finding. Okay. One is sort of a very strong signal which distinguishes the coding region from the non-coding region. And that signal, as we'll talk later, can come from different sources. The others are sort of weaker signals that actually give you the boundaries of these exons. These signals are weaker, but they are more specific because as soon as you identify the GT, you know exactly where the boundary is. The other signals are stronger, but their boundaries are not as well defined. So the combination of two is basically what people think can give them the right structure. And all of the gene finding algorithms right from the beginning to what's going on now do try to play with these two things and see what's the best way of combining these signals. So we won't talk a lot. There's a lot of history behind gene finding, and already, you know, GenScan and all are already not the first generation of programs. There were people were writing code to identify coding regions and all much before the so-called ab initio methods, the HMM-based methods sort of. I'll describe that in a minute. But this class of so-called ab initio because the only clues that you use for finding the gene comes from the genomic sequence itself, and the hidden Markov model-based gene identification programs are sort of the dominant players in this. Although there are, you know, other approaches as well based on neural networks and so on. So the idea here is quite straightforward. I mean, the devil is in the details, so it's not as trivial as one might think, but it can be explained. The basic idea can be explained. Think of a Markov chain, which is a model of a typical gene structure. So you might have some intergenic region. You might have a start, a signal which determines the start, and then there is some kind of a signal which is the coding exon. Then you have exons and introns sort of interleaving. Finally, the terminating exon, then again intergenic, and so on. So, given such a model, right, and you have some parameters for when a particular set of nucleotides can lie in the model, which gives you the probability of that happening, you can thread a genomic sequence, or you can parse a genomic sequence according to this model, and then every nucleotide can be identified as belonging to either an intron, a start, an exon, and this parse essentially gives you the gene structure. Okay, so that's the idea. The reason these methods are so powerful is because there's a well-understood mechanism for both training the parameters of this model, and as well as for once you have trained to parse out the genomic structure. Both of these things are well known from other sort of from a long time back. So you can apply the methodology straight off without too much of details, but then you apply your knowledge of biology in determining what each of these models look like, and that gives you a pretty accurate parse. Okay. And they seem to work quite well, except that there have been recent studies, one of which is Geigel 99, that say that they're not the final word in gene finding. So gene finding continues to be an active area of research, even with the success of these models. And there are a couple of reasons why this happens. The first is that the signals in the initial and the final exons are kind of weak, because those exons are typically smaller. And also, there are large intergenic regions that separate two genes. So there is a pretty good chance that you might find something that looks like an exon in the intergenic region. So when these genes are, when the sparse is done on a large region which contains many genes, it always, it sometimes gets confused at the boundaries. So that's one of the places where it could be a problem. So to sort of partly because of historic reasons and partly to address this difficulty, there were these so-called homology-based methods. So what these methods are is also easy to explain. In this case, what people assumed is that as more and more genes are found, in different species, it was found that because of evolution, you would find the same gene or its orthologue or even, something which is a close paralog or something which had similar sequence would be found in other organisms. So if you had a new genome, but you had the corresponding gene or a gene with a pretty similar sequence in another gene in another organism, you could compare the two and therefore get the boundaries of the coding regions in the new genome. And the good part of this is that they're sort of insensitive to the intergenic region, because you could have the cDNA and then there could be a large intergenic region and there would be no need to be confused by that. But there are, these methods are not, there are problems with these methods as well, primarily because you really need to have a close homolog. As the amount of sequence similarity diminishes, the accuracy of these methods goes down. So if you had a mouse transcript, for example, it would be very easy to find a human transcript. And likewise, if you had a human transcript, it would be easy to find the mouse. Easy, quote unquote easy. But if you had C. elegans as your reference organism in human, then it's not quite so clear. So just to give you an idea, there are some of these compare against a protein sequence, like GeneWise, while others, and Procrustes, while others like SIM4 can compare against cDNA sequence. And they're all variants of the same kind of methodology. Okay. So mouse, I mentioned, that if you have a mouse transcript, it'd be easy to find the gene. And this, there was a study done in 96 and then repeated in 99 with a bigger set, which actually confirmed this to some extent. They took about 1,156 transcripts, orthologs in human and mouse, and found something very striking. Orthologous coding regions in human and mouse are 85% identical at both amino acid and at nucleotide level. Okay, so that's a very strong similarity. It practically means that if you had the mouse transcript, by and large, for the average gene, you could pretty much recover the gene just based on comparative methods. Okay, and furthermore, the similarity doesn't extend to non-coding regions. So that's something interesting. Mouses seems to be at the right genetic distance. If you had human and chimp, for example, there would be so much similarity in non-coding that, again, these gene-finding methods might not work. So human, and then that's one of the reasons why it's useful to do the mouse genome, because in addition to mouse being an important laboratory animal, the comparative genomics is much better. However, if you have a mouse protein, you'd probably have the corresponding human protein as well. So there are very few mouse proteins. You cannot really apply the homology-based method because people have already done it. In some extent, there's not much hope of finding new genes. But there is something else that you can try, which is, given that you have two genomic regions, you can simultaneously find novel genes in both human and mouse genomes. Based on comparative methods, because you know that there's very little similarity in non-coding and a lot of similarity in coding regions. So that's what this paper will talk about. It'll take human and mouse as examples, but one could imagine two novel genomes that have been sequenced, which are very close to one another, and you could apply a method like this to find genes. Syntenic? Yes. So syntenic, I'm using this term in a sense that's not strictly correct, but it seems to be the sense in which everybody is now using it. So that's the way it really means, on the same band. So if you look at the banding patterns, human and mouse, syntenic genes are things that sort of come close to one another. That's
the banding patterns in general, what's the reason?
No, in the chromosome. When you do, what is it that you do to get those banding patterns? Actually, I don't even remember, but. Yeah, the staining to get the banding patterns. So I think that, am I wrong in this, in my definition of syntony? Mark, you might be able to. That's right? Okay, so So as far as I know, so that's what it really means, to things that line sort of the same banding pattern. And if you took a human chromosome and then you took the syntenic mouse chromosome, then you would find the two genes. And that's the sense in which this is being used. It's not, so like I said, it's not strictly correct because it really...
Do you happen to know why there's a difference in bands? Is it the difference in
chromatin? Yeah, that's what people assume. But I don't think that has been resolved yet. To the best of my knowledge, it's not resolved.
It's a mixture of chromatin structure, but also just the GC content.
GC content.
Yeah. Absorbs
stuff. Okay, thank you.
So some characters are just saying it's the chromosomes between human muscle and real ends.
Yes.
But not fragmented down to the level of genes, but a big section of maybe 100 genes in the level of human level. And maybe a human chromosome 6, and those same genes will be on the mouse chromosome 4. So we say those two, or the same chromosomes are syntonic.
Exactly. Those two regions of the chromosome are syntonic, right. Okay, so because I'm not sure whether I need to do this or not, I want to give a little bit of a background as to how these comparative methods work. So, you know, I already talked about the existing methods compare a genomic DNA sequence against either a transcript DNA of another species or protein sequence of another species. And the syntenic method compares two DNA from genomic sequence of two species. So, but the ideas behind those comparisons are somewhat similar, and I want to give you a flavor for how this is done, just to get an idea of what that computationally it's not. It's quite expensive to do this unless you're sort of careful about how you do it. Okay, so let's just talk about something which is a classic problem in computer science called the edit distance problem. Think of two strings. Here they are over A, C, G's, and T's. But they could be over, you know, it could be a string over any alphabet. And the question that you ask is, what's the minimum number of insertions, deletions, and substitutions you need to do in order to get from one string to another? Okay, that's one way of formulating the problem. So as soon as you've identified a set of insertions, deletions, and substitutions, you can create what is called an alignment. So here you have these two strings. We start with two insertions. So let's say we're trying to convert this into this. We start with three insertions, then this is an identical letter, so there's no change here. Then there's one substitution, and then everything else is identical. Right? So in general, you could put, what you could do is take this string and open gaps anywhere in between, and that would give you an alignment. It would also give you a way of transforming one into another using these operations. Yet another way to look at it is, give each pair a score. So give A against A a score, give T against A a score, give T against a gap a score. And then you say, for all possible alignments, which alignment gives you the best score? And you can see that there is not much difference in all of these formulations. Okay. This is sort of the crux of all the alignment-based techniques. So what you want is, given two strings, you want to find an alignment that maximizes the score. And again, you know, you could have a probabilistic model, and then you could say that give an alignment that's the most likely alignment. Or you could, you know, go down and do other things like what's the set of most likely alignments and so on. Okay, here's how this problem is done. The reason you can do it is because in order to, you ask this question of any pair of prefixes of the two strings. So let's say that we were asking this question about the prefix from here to here, okay, and the prefix from here to here. Now there are only a few things that can happen. Either this A is aligned with this A. Okay, in that case, the score would be the score of aligning these A's plus the score of aligning the remaining prefix against the remaining prefix. That's one. The other thing that could happen is that this A is deleted. So that would be aligning this against this, against a dash, and then aligning the remaining sequence against this prefix, and symmetrically in the other direction. Okay, so if you do those three computations here, assuming that you've done all the prefix computations before, you can get what's the best cost of aligning this prefix against this prefix. And then you can ask this question for any pair of prefixes, okay, doing only a constant amount of work at each step. And therefore, in time that's proportional to the product of these two lengths, you can actually get the maximum scoring alignment for two sequences. Okay, do you have any questions on this? Okay. So let's extend this a little more to the case where you have genomic DNA on one side, okay? So it could have introns, exons, and it could have coding regions. And you have amino acids at the other end. Okay, so that's the prototypical alignment, it's sort of homology-based algorithm, like GeneWise, for example, does this, and ProCrustes does this as well. But they do it in slightly different techniques, different ways. So think of aligning this prefix against this prefix. There are many ways in which you can do it. You can imagine that this triplet, the ATG, corresponds to a codon, which codes for methionine, incidentally. And that entire codon is aligned against this. So that's what I've put here. Okay? So the score of that would be the score of this versus and sum to the score of aligning this prefix to the prefix here. Now here again you have multiple choices. You can choose to align this S against this prefix here, TAG, which is the next triplet that comes, right? But TAG actually stands for a stop codon. And you know, you don't really want an alignment in which you have a stop codon in the middle of your frame. So that probably, if you give that a very high penalty, that should not be the optimum score. But if you look carefully, this AG could be the left endpoint of an exon. So there could be an exon boundary here, right? And if you maintain what's the best score, given that this is an exon, this could be an intron, then you could go back and align S to the place where the intron might have started, which is given by this cheeky. If you maintain appropriate amount of information, I'm not doing this very carefully, you can actually, in constant number of steps again, you can say what's the best alignment of this prefix against this, allowing different kinds of penalties. Penalties for opening gaps, penalties for opening frame shifts, because there might be sequencing errors, and penalties for opening introns, which you don't really want to penalize too much, as long as the intron junctions are maintained. Okay? So it's a much larger number of steps per prefix pair, but it's still constant. It's independent of the length of the two sequences. And again, in time, that's sort of roughly proportional to the product of these lengths, you can do it. However, this computation is actually quite prohibitive. And the reason is simply that genomic sequences are not your average. You know, an average gene might be 3,000 base pairs, but it might extend over a genomic sequence that's 10 kb. So if you take 10 kb times, you know, say 500 amino acids, that's already a pretty large computation, given that the constant at each prefix pair is pretty expensive. So that's not how the homology-based algorithms do it. They do it using some tricks, but those we won't go into. We'll instead go to the syntenic gene finding. Now note that the problem here is really compounded, because not only do you have a genomic sequence here, you have a genomic sequence here. So there's like 10 to 50 kb here and 10 to 50 kb here. You could, in principle, and actually there was a paper, I don't know if it's published, by a French group, which gave the recurrence relations for doing this dynamic programming, in which you're allowed indels, residue shifts, as well as introns at both ends. So you know, it's a pretty complicated recurrence relation, but you can, if you like, find the optimum alignment of two genomic strings. But it's not feasible. No computer today can do it, including the most powerful ones. On the other hand, if you there are a whole suite of other programs that already tell you approximately where the gene should be. So these are, BLAST is one, and there are SIM and PipMaker. There are other sort of software. What they do is the following. They look at, they do a quick scan to see where conserved keywords are. So they could be a word of length 3 or 4 that matches in both genomes. And then they do a local alignment around that point. So they do this and greedily they extend this alignment. So what they get is a series of small greedy alignments. Okay. So pretty much if there is a good exon somewhere which is conserved in human and mouse, you would find that somewhere in the genome. Okay.
So a greedy extension keeps going until the score starts dropping?
Yeah. So they have some thresholds, but typically if the score falls below, say, 30% of the top score that it found, then it stops. Some things. It's The exact strategy is different for different programs, but that's the spirit of it. So what you see is all of these black lines, right? And you know that your genes should be somewhere approximately in this. And in fact, the blue things give the boundary of the gene. So you have, these are the exons of a true gene. It's called ornithine. This is about 10 kb of a mouse sequence, 10 kb of a human. The black ones actually correspond to the T-blastex alignments. So you can see that the T-blastex alignments do seem to capture most of where the gene is, but there's a lot of spurious stuff. And the second thing is that you don't exactly know where the boundaries are. Okay. So our goal is to use a local alignment like this, which can be done much faster than this global alignment, and then extend it in a clever fashion that you can find the boundaries of these genes correctly. Okay. So that's sort of the way in which we'll approach this problem. So here's the idea. First, consider this as a sort of detailed look at what an alignment might look like. Let this black line be the blast alignment. Okay, so it's a local alignment. We know that there is some exon pair in mouse and in human, which approximately is found by this alignment. But we don't know, this alignment could have gone all the way past the splice boundary, or it could be somewhere before. We don't really know. Now, what we do is first we scan this human sequence to find all the acceptor and donor sites. And here we might use our favorite signal finding algorithm. So there'll be a whole bunch of splice sites that you'll find with acceptor and donor, and likewise in mouse. Any pair of acceptor and donor site here will be an exon, and is a putative exon, and any pair here is an exon. So one stupid strategy might be that you take all possible pairs and do an alignment. But again, that's too many computations, because there are lots of these sequences around. So here's the second assumption that we make. So given that we are saying that there should be an exon here just based on this T-blastex alignment, it's pretty reasonable to assume that at least some portion of that alignment, of the true exon-exon alignment and the T-blastex alignment, will intersect. Okay, so what you do is you take a point here, and then you know that the alignment, if this is the sweet region of the alignment, you pretty much know that the exon will pass through this. Okay, so once you have any fixed point like that, you can do two dynamic programming computations. In the first, you take all of the GT pairs, so you have all of these, but in a single computation of this, in a single dynamic programming computation of this region, you can find the score from each of these putative boundary to the center point in the single computation. So in two computations, you can get basically all the pairs, and then if you wanted the score for any particular pair, that would just be the score from here to here and from here to here. Okay.
Would you expect typically the alternate?
Well, if this was a true exon,
yes,
then you would have an AG here and you would have a GT here. So that property has to be there. That's why all of this is just
GTs.
Some of them could be false. So you take this and you make, again, a graph out of it. This is the center node. Each of these corresponds to a GT pair, but they could also correspond to a stop site. And this could also, and likewise, each of these corresponds to this intron exon pair, but they could also correspond to a start site. And then the score of this edge is nothing but the score of the alignment from here to here, and likewise here to here. Of course, you could do this next obvious thing and take the maximum scoring alignment, but that might not be very smart, because what might be locally the best alignment might not fit well into a gene structure. That's one thing. There's another thing, a subtle point that you must keep in mind. These are all DNA sequences, but we want to do the scoring at sort of the amino acid level. And the problem is that these exons are not always, the introns don't always split at codon boundaries. So you could have an overhang of one or two nucleotides here. So what we do is we penalize indels heavily. We allow indels because of sequencing errors and such. We allow them inside the alignment, but we penalize them heavily. But towards the end, if there's an indel of one or two one or two nucleotides, there's no penalty. So not only do you have the score, you also have an overhang in each end, whether it's a one nucleotide overhang or a two nucleotide overhang. Okay.
You they penalize? There's no systematic way of determining the best set of penalties.
There is a system. That's, yeah. So these are the parameters of the problem. The there's no systematic learning algorithm. But if you sort of ran this over a bunch of true examples,
yes,
and you played around with the parameters using a standard sort of learning technique, then you could get the right parameters. But in practice, and I'll go back to this, we didn't have to do much of that because the signals are very strong. So even with some easy choice of parameters, it seems to work out. Although that is not to say that the results won't improve if you did this systematically.
I'm curious about the result, if you learn some examples, like does it correspond to one of those Gaussian matrices?
So, hold on. So when we do the alignment, right, when we do the structure, we do use the Blossom matrix to compute the alignment.
By the way, you learn from some examples.
Right.
You know anything. You know these
examples. Oh, even for the matching score functions?
Yeah.
I would think they do, yes, because...
But you haven't looked at it.
No, but I'm very confident that you would, because of this result, that 85% of them are identical and so on at the amino acid.
I'm not concerned about the result, but I wanted to learn something about evolution, in fact, because the relation between non-human and
other. Right, so we haven't done it like that, but I'm quite convinced that you would, because of the high identity, you would not, there wouldn't be a problem. Yeah. Sorry, was there a question? Okay, so at the end of this protocol, you have a bunch of these spiders. So-called, right? Well, you do one more thing, and then you're all sort of set to find the genes.
And the spider arms are not really straight lines; there's some paths.
There's some paths. Yeah, yeah. That path we don't have to maintain because once you know a global path, we can recompute the path. So we actually don't maintain the path; only maintain the score at that point, and then we recompute when we need to. Yeah. So think of this as the center node of one spider, and let's say that this is the donor node, and likewise this is the center node of another spider and an acceptor node. You connect this an edge from here to here if the overhangs exactly correspond, exactly maintain frame. So if there, when you say there was an overhang of 2 here, that means essentially the alignment was ACT was aligned to ACT here, and the CAT was aligned to CAA. And then an overhang of 2 nucleotides and 1 nucleotide was left here and here. And likewise, an overhang of 1 and 2 was left. So when you, if you were to combine them, then this CTT would form one exon and this TAA would form the other exon. If you're maintaining frame like this, by all means, connect them by an edge. And here, if you like, you can weight this edge according to the strength of the two signals. We don't do that, okay, just to, but this is a possibility. So once you do that, then you have a graph, okay, which goes, which basically connects these spiders together because now you have ways of connecting. And then you take a path from a start, then to the center, which is the only place you can go to another exon boundary, and then so on till you come to a start. And then you project. How do you take the path? This region, so you don't penalize, but you score them according to the strength of the splice signal, and then you just take the maximum scoring path, and that can be done by
you're
a second. Yes, we don't penalize according. There's no length penalty because introns, the statistics on intron length. So that was something that was troublesome to me about HMMs. Although I could be wrong on this, is because there's no easy way to model introns and intergenic regions. They're typically modeled using an exponential distribution, which means that if you had, if you're comparing two parses of the same length, it doesn't matter. But otherwise, there is something strange about longer introns getting sort of heavier penalty than shorter introns. They're being somewhat less likely. And this sort of skirts over the issue. Whether or not this is the right thing, I'm not sure. But it, in my opinion, this is one way of handling with that problem. Okay, so the best scoring path, once you project them in these two directions, will give you the gene in those organisms. So that's basically it. There isn't a whole lot more.
To calculate the best scoring path, you now have to take into account the detail.
No. Remember that we don't have to take into account the path itself, but we have the score of this edge, which is the score of the alignment from here to here.
The best alignment.
From here to here, yes. The score we maintain, but we don't maintain the path.
I can just remember the score.
Yeah. So you can just go down, and then once you know what it is, then you recompute the path from here to here, from here to here, and that's a very cheap computation compared to everything else that you do. So. Yes.
Do mice have the same type of alternative splicing, and is the alternative splicing conserved? And if so, what, or in these cases, what happens here when you have?
It's a good question. I'll talk about it in the two things. One is that the alternative splice forms exist in both human and mouse, and they sort of, the boundaries are conserved. So. Okay, that's a more difficult case. I'll come back to that later. But the simple answer is that if there was an exon that was, either spliced in or spliced out, then that would just give you and if it was present in both human and mouse, it would give you an alternative parse. But of course, if there was an exon in human that was not present in mouse at all, it'll never be found by this. So the method, that's why this is research, and that's why this is not like the defining gene finding method, because it uses one evidence, which is homology, and it ignores all the statistical evidence, which in the past has worked very well. So, in reality, you'd like to combine all those sources, but. Okay, this is a little bit of a detail. So, how do you find this? This stands for a directed acyclic graph. So, there is no cycle because you only have edges sort of going in this direction. And that's what makes this computation of this optimum scoring path quick. Otherwise, if you had cycles, you could still do it, but it would not be as straightforward. Yeah.
So this alternative splicing, this seems to be a great way to see the alternative.
Yes.
Splicing.
Yes. If the exon was conserved in both, yes, you just do different passes. Not only that, if you wanted to see alternative gene structures, right, you could just take the next best scoring path. You can do all of those things. You can think of these as probabilities, and you can generate things according to the probability distribution. All of the things that are possible for alignments are now possible for this.
So
the whole machinery.
How often do you see them?
There is no way to tell, because, I mean, unless somebody is willing to do the experiments on the basis of our predictions, there's no way to tell. Oh yes.
There's no alternative splicing. You just see one strong path.
No, that's not quite true. Because see, as long as this frame is conserved between this and this, you could always have this as a valid gene structure. You could always splice out an exon. There's nothing to see. That's true. See, the problem that you're talking about exists even without this comparison. Supposing you were just doing gene finding on a single genomic sequence, right? Is this sort of high enough that if I write here, people can see? Okay. So, let's say that this. Okay, let's say that each of these was at a codon boundary. Okay, so a codon exactly ended here, and a codon exactly ended here, and here, and here. There is nothing to say that this is not a valid parse of the gene, right? Right. So the problem of alternatives, we don't do anything. Like, our method doesn't give you any special advantage. All it's saying is that, yes, any valid parse like this, you can see. But unless you have other evidence, there's no reason to choose that parse over this. The reason you choose this parse over the other one is, for the de novo case, of course, it's what is the probability that, you, in spite of all the evolution, you still have strong statistics that this is a coding region. It's very small. So you want to take this. Yeah.
It's probably unlikely that you have exactly the same alternative splicing
That's not true because, we are basing our assumption on the fact that these are orthologous genes for the most part, and they do more or less the same thing. Their function is more or less the same. We would even go so far as to say that a lot of them are under the same regulatory control because a lot of human diseases are mimicked in mouse. So, the genes are doing, essentially you have fat mice and mice with heart disease and all of the things that genes are doing in human beings, they're doing in, not all, but a large fraction they would be doing in mouse as well. So, yeah, but yes, in the case that they are not truly orthologous and there's something that's different, this method won't work.
You said mouse and human are more or less done or on the way to being done, but the hope is to use this method for other pairs of organisms that are
different. As well, yeah. Yeah, which are at the similar level, a similar genetic distance as human and mouse. Okay, so that's just the method again. Just a few extra points. So what do you do if you have multiple gene structures? That's not very hard to handle because you can allow edges between the stop of one gene and the start of another gene. And then, and likewise, if you have genes, you could have genes on either strand. So you make the prediction in all possible pairs and then you combine the data from all of that. Non-conserved splice sites. This one is very tricky. We'll talk a little bit about that. But it just so happens that when they did this analysis of these 1,000 transcripts in human and mouse, they found that not only were the genes conserved, the splice junctions were also conserved. However, it could be, and this is, I don't think there's not much evidence for this. And there wasn't in the examples that we looked at, so, oh shit. What's the problem here? Okay. So what happens, let's say that this is the human gene, and let's say that this is the mouse gene. And let's say a deletion event happened and totally removed this intron. That could happen. So you actually have one exon here and one and two exons here. We haven't seen a lot of that, but there's no reason to believe that. And there's no reason that this won't happen, given that insertions and deletions are pretty common. So there is a way to handle this, and it's again by not penalizing gaps that are at the end. So you can think of the graph when you compute the structure for this and this. Okay, you basically align this to this, and all the penalty that you get for opening a gap here, you give it free because it's a terminal penalty. And likewise, you do it for here. Let's say that this was combined. You can do it for this and this. And then when you're merging the two, you do a subsequent alignment at that point. It can be done in principle, but because we don't have enough data to test these, we haven't implemented that portion. But that's a problem. The other thing is that, you know, as people do, it seems like whole genome shotgun, is going to be one of the ways in which a lot of the assembly is going to be done. So a lot of the data initially will be unassembled and it will be in fragments. Again, this method is good because you only need order in one of the two genomic sequences. The other you can pretty much order based on the local alignments. Okay. And finally, the performance, it's quite good. I don't want to give exact numbers. I mean, I don't have exact numbers on me, but in terms of computational speed, essentially you're doing, for about 10 KB regions, you have 300 or so local alignments that you have to do. And it's expensive as compared to ab initio gene finding methods, but it's pretty comparable to any homology-based method, even though the homology-based methods are protein versus genomic, and not genomic versus genomic. Okay.
And orthologous is different from
yes, orthologous really refers to having the same function. So you say syntenic regions of the genome, but then orthologous genes are the... So the problem with the results is, of course, that we have very limited test data for this. So we have about, what we found was this thing from Ewan Birney and Nicholas Yarborg at the Sanger Center. They had 61 pairs of genomic orthologous genomic sequence, each with orthologous human and mouse genes. We selected about 27 for training, and I say training with some limitation because we didn't do it in any systematic fashion. Our main goal was to debug our algorithm. We didn't really explicitly train on parameters. We wanted to see what was the power of this method. So we didn't do much with splice, adding sort of splice site junctions and so on. We took every splice junction that scored over a certain threshold was taken as equally, as scoring the same. So we didn't do any strong training. Okay. But we did use 27 to sort of debug different aspects of our algorithm. And then we measured what are the classic measures. So the specificity is the true positives over the total number of predictions, and the sensitivity is the true positives over the total number of true positives. And You can see that in all of these categories, it's pretty comparable to GenScan. And the other thing is, of course, that while we make a prediction simultaneously on human and mouse, if you're wrong, we're wrong twice, and if you're right, we're right twice. And of course, GenScan predicts independently, but we take all of them as separate prediction. There's no, I mean, it's not being unfair to either side, I think. So we take them.
Where the genes are, so the section where the genes contain is already given to you.
Yes. Yes.
What if we include also the intergenic region?
Yeah, we haven't tested it explicitly because very little data was of that multiple gene type. But the jury is out on it. I'm not sure how it'll. I think it'll perform okay because the similarity is much stronger in the coding regions. But the same, but similar problems arise. I mean, I'm not sure. I don't have a good answer to that one. That, yes, that's right. But they, I think they have, is it 99? They have another paper which just talks about the data set, but yes, it's the same data set.
What is the label in the column, the SM and
SP? Right, sorry. So, yeah, I should say this more clearly. Okay, so exon sensitivity is sensitivity at the exon level, and nucleotide sensitivity is sensitivity at the nucleotide level. So roughly, okay, when you take every nucleotide, you're cheating in a sense because what you really care about exons. But on the other hand, if you just take exon sensitivity and exon specificity, then in a sense you're only caring about the boundaries and you forget that you got most of the exon correct. So people use both of these methods, both of these, sorry, measures to make sure. No. But it's a good question that you asked because a lot of these genes are similar to the original training set for GenScan for human. And the fact that the mouse genes are very similar, it's not surprising that GenScan performs very well on this data set. So it is, yes. Yes, if the structure wasn't well conserved, in that case, it could be. Oh, it could be, but it doesn't happen. It's just because at least in these examples, the gene structure is more or less the same. So, because we are predicting the gene structure simultaneously, and the gene structures are pretty similar, I don't know. It could happen. I mean, it could happen, but it doesn't. Most of the times, the error is either in both or not.
In general,
it can happen, yeah.
And if it is this case for this 61 pairs, it would mean this sample is certain bias.
Oh, why? Oh, because in general it's quite possible, you're saying? Yeah, I have no way of, you're exactly right in the sense that this data set is too small. I don't even want to draw sort of strong conclusions that we are better. This is just like a proof of the principle, but not really to say that this is the best method out there.
Back to your procedure of stitching these things together.
Yes.
Since you don't use any gap penalty, won't that be in the global?
We do use alignment. We do use gap penalties.
No.
When we are doing the local alignment.
Region,
Locally we have gap penalties. Yeah, when we stitch them, we don't.
Together.
Yeah, we don't. Because
then
there is.
You can go arbitrary. I mean, each one of these has some positive scores.
Yes.
Then you can extend.
Yes, yes, you could. However, this is the thing, it's the same thing that you do in the single case. Given that you have a fixed length genomic sequence, what are the different possible parses of that into exons and introns? The best one of that should be the one that corresponds to the right one, irrespective of how many exons there are in each gene. If you take a large number of exons for one gene, you're going to screw up the other gene in some sense. Okay, there's one more reason why this method is interesting, and that is the following. It's a psychological thing, but often when people do gene finding, the first thing, there's no way to just look at a gene prediction and say that this is correct. So what they do is they take the predicted gene and blast it or compare it against some other species and look at the alignments to see if the alignments make sense. In this case, the alignment comes for free, because not only do you get a prediction, you also get the alignment with the corresponding. So that's one of the advantages, because for the human annotator, the alignment is a very powerful way of saying whether the gene structure makes sense. And it's also interesting because there are a large number of cases where our prediction was so-called wrong. But if you look at the alignments that you get, the alignments are reasonable that these could well be alternative structures. And while there's no way to say either case, even for ab initio that could be true, here at least the alignment gives you some confidence that you're not doing something totally off the mark. So, for example, look at this big gap here. This is the actual gene prediction, whereas the gene that we predicted was right here because there was there's a splice boundary right here as well. So who is to say that that's not the true, that the human gene does not have an alternative splice form in which this doesn't exist? Because there is a mouse form which looks just like that, right? So that's just one example. So this, if you use this method, you might get, it's another way of, and it could help in annotation just because there's more than just a gene prediction with a score. Okay, so I'm almost done. I think I just want to summarize something that I said before. There are two main components. We use, the ideas that you separate coding from non-coding really comes from two places. One is that you use statistical evidence, but in this case we use comparative evidence. And we just want to say that that could be very useful for new genomes. Okay, that's all. Thank you. Okay, we now